Good evening and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, June 30th, 2000. Tonight, in the Creekside Room, Mary Scott Boria continues her investigation of social justice, transforming a vision. Tonight's session is entitled Racial Reconciliation, A Spiritual Journey, A Spiritual Dialogue. This is session SBM 2000-4. Let's listen in.
I was in the other room for a couple of days, so they put me in here and threw me off balance. And so I'm trying to get my bearings being in another room, and it's me. It's not the place. It's me. So I've used the board a little bit, but we're not going to use the board very much. I realized that several of you have been here for a couple of the sessions, and several of you have not. Several of you are new. And so I wanted to spend just a few minutes kind of saying a little bit about what we've done for the last couple of days, because we saw a video on Wednesday that took an hour and a half, and we didn't have a chance to talk about it at all. And so I understand that people have had a chance to talk about it and would like to talk a little bit about it. So for those of you that didn't see the video, I apologize to you, but hopefully we can be graphic enough to express what it was about. And I have it here, and I'll be here for another week. So I'll be using it again next week. And if anyone is interested in seeing it, I'm happy to have it available for you to look at. The name of it is The Way Home, and it was a pretty long video. What we've done this week, let me just tell you a little bit about what I do and why it's such a dilemma for me to figure out how to break it up in 1 hour, 5 day sessions. And you're shaking your head, so you know what that's like. I work with a group called Crossroads Ministries in Chicago, and Crossroads Ministries, the founder of Crossroads Ministries, Joe Byrne, is a Lutheran, and has a love-hate relationship with the ELCA, so I'm not here to promote Joe Byrne or Crossroads, but to say a little bit about what we do, and sort of talk a little bit about the model of racism, or dismantling racism that we do, because that's been a little bit of my dilemma in trying to sort of figure out how to unpack and sort of understand how to unpack based upon the audience that is at Holden, which may be different than the audience that we see. And I'm finding that the audience at Holden is a lot more progressive than the audience that we see back at home. So to sort of bring the model up to where people are. But Crossroads Ministries started about 10 years ago, and it is an organization that works with churches mostly and other institutions to help institutions to develop an institutional team that looks at dismantling racism from their own institution. And so what's unique about it is that people from churches, lots of different denominations, not just Lutheran, but Episcopalian and Catholic and other groups, come with the commitment of developing a team within the institution to look at their own institution and the role that their own institution plays in living out racism in the institution and thinking about not only dismantling racism within the institution, but in the context of which they're in. And so the model is based specifically for groups that are interested in developing a team. And so if any of you, some of your churches have been involved, I've been in Minnesota quite a lot in the last 6 months, and some of the churches in the Minnesota area, many of them have been Lutheran churches and have been organized by Lutheran churches. So there's a lot going on in Minnesota. At least I've spent a lot of time in Minnesota. And the model is really a three-phase model. The first phase of the model is really to call a team. And a team is called by the authority in the church, so that, you know, probably many of you have worked in situations where sort of you're the radical wing of whatever, you sort of do whatever, and sometimes it gets sanctioned by the institution. More likely than not, you get kicked out of the institution and you go someplace else and do your radical work, right? But the goal of organizing a team is really to get buy-in from the institution, so that is really sanctioned by the forces within the institution that can shape what happens to the life in that church. Now, that doesn't mean that the radical element isn't involved in that. What that means is that the radical element figures out how to co-opt the leadership in the church to make that happen. And so that process is really, for some organizations, it takes years for a team to be called within the institution, because we're talking about a 20, 30-year transformation process. And many institutions have very short memories and very short visions. And so thinking about a 30-year plan, you know, we've been in the business of dismantling racism for 400 years, right? And so we think that we can do it in a year, and if it isn't done in a year, we're just not quite happy with ourselves and we want to get on to something else. Well, so it's a big commitment to say we will work on this as long as it takes and do whatever it takes. So that's the first phase. The second phase is really to train a team to understand together an analysis of racism. And I always, this is the place where I'm always stuck, because I always go into a group, I'm really apprehensive, I'm really scared, because I don't know where people are. And I don't know where individuals are, and I don't know where the group is. And you really sometimes are seduced into assuming that people are at one place or another. And I'm always surprised after 2.5 days how much of an impact understanding a little word like racism has on an institution. And so some people, again, that's a big commitment. 2 days out of your life, 2.5 days out of your life, are busy lives. There's sometimes more than people have to give when you've got all these other competing. But after 2.5 days, a team is pretty much ready then to be called to do the work of organizing a dismantling process within their institution or their church. And then the third phase is really the phase of that team developing its unique way in which it goes about looking at racism within its own congregation or group, and then designing a process that's unique to that institution. Most people that come to the training on the first day will say, you know, we've talked about racism forever. We just now want to talk about how do we get rid of it, because we've heard all of this before. And you know, we're always sort of stuck because, you know, we don't have those answers. They're too, you know, the answers are too complex. And really, the path that an institution takes is its own path, because your history is your history. Who you are, the context in which you operate is your own context, even though we have a context of understanding racism in the United States, how it unfolds in your own sort of institution is unique to you. So the third phase of the model is really working. Some teams are 5 people, some teams are 150 people, depending upon how we're working with the Unitarians, and the Unitarians team is about 150 people, and that spans several churches, so it's a denominational team. I know that there are many Lutheran synods that have teams, and there are many congregations that have teams, and there are many Lutheran churches that have other groups that they work with, not sort of using the Crossroads model. But the goal is really to have that team become the leadership body within the church to move that church along whatever path or plan they design for themselves. But it's really based upon that second phase of really understanding how racism operates within their midst. So I kind of wanted to describe that a little bit, because the work that I've been doing this week, or how I've thought about it this week, is how do you take 2.5 days, and I mean 2.5 days, meaning 16-hour days, 8 to 16, and pack it into 4 or 5 hours of the week, and really kind of figure out where people are and try to pinpoint, you know, what are the most important pieces, without doing injustice to the model. And I think the problem is that when you get a little dose of racism, or understanding racism, it either stirs you up, makes you mad, or does something that then I can't fulfill because I'm gone or you're gone. And so really trying to figure out how to package this in a different way has been a real challenge. And so what I've done this week is to really kind of think about some of those components. So on day one, what we did is, and I when I do it like this, I don't follow the Crossroads model. And so if any of you know Joe Barney, you see him, don't tell him. but what I tried to do is to really kind of dramatize a little bit, I think, the sort of pieces of understanding racism that are, you know, would be a lot more elaborate if we were to do it in a 2.5 day. So on day one, what we did was we started talking a little bit about institutional racism. And we kind of did that from the framework of looking at the video Cosmic Slop. The video Cosmic Slop was based upon, adapted by a book written by Derek Bell called Faces at the Bottom of the Well. And the book is in the library, so if any of you want to take it, I was going to take it and copy the chapter, but I don't know what the copyright laws are here. I don't tend to respect the copyright laws, but since I'm a guest here, I didn't want to break those rules.
Up to 25% of the book.
Oh, okay. So anyway, I may have copies of it at some point, but it's here if you're interested in reading the chapter. But it's basically a situation where black people are basically sent off to outer space. Aliens come and say, we will give you everything that you need in this country to solve all of your economic, social problems, but you got to give us your black people. And so the video just sort of shows all the different arguments that people make about whether or not they should send them or not send them. And it's a pretty sort of satirical look at of what we don't think could ever possibly happen, right? Well, we had the rabbi in the room that day, and he came back the next day and said they did this to Jews 50 years ago. And
that's in space.
Right? and so it's not a remote thing. But it, you know, it sort of dramatized the decisions that were made and sort of how is it possible that a group of people are so expendable. And so that we talked about the first day, we sort of tried to weave institutional racism in there by looking at, you know, what are the forms of racism that impact the life of people of color, and how does society think about that? And so then we sort of talked a little bit about some of the forms of institutional racism that currently exist. And for me, one of the biggest forms of institutional racism is what's happening in the criminal justice system. And so it's not so far removed for me to think that if we're shipping them off to jails, you know, I mean, the next step could be someplace else. And when 1 in 3 black men in this country are in our federal prison, are in our prison system, it isn't such a remote idea to think, and you have to stop and think, why is that, what's going on? And so that's sort of the tip of the iceberg, I think. So we kind of talked a little bit about that. And then on the second day, we looked at the concept of race. And so what does race mean? And what does being white mean? That was sort of how we focused. What does it mean to be white in America? And lots of people never think about being white. Never think about it. I think about being a person of color all the time. I had a reaction the first day that I was here, and I was talking about how I think about being a person of color all the time. I all the time I think about it. I don't want to think about it all the time. I just do. That's the function of racism, for me to think about it and for you not to have to think about it. And so, I don't know, my two grandchildren are here, and my little grandson, he looks like a little white boy. And if he wasn't with me, you'd probably think he was probably a little white boy. And so he did something one day, and I thought, oh, and I said to my husband, I just had a real nasty thought that went through my head. And I was even embarrassed to tell my husband. I said, but you know, I'm so glad that he looks like a little white boy. Because if he didn't look like a little white boy, then we would all be indicted for his behavior. And so, you know, sort of that function of race sort of makes people of color conscious of it, because that's what defines our reality in this country. And for whites, not thinking about it is what defines the reality for whites in this country. So we talked about race the second day. And then the third day, we showed a video. The video was called The Way Home. And it's a 1997 video, and it shows a group of women, well, it shows actually seven groups of women grouped in racial groups, sort of talking about the impact of race on their life. So we see African American women, we see Asian women, we see indigenous women, we see Arab women, we see mixed race women, and we see white women, and we see Jewish women talking about the function of race in their life. And so we spent our time kind of thinking about that. So what I thought we'd do today before we got into thinking about, you know, kind of talking about what our topic was, and we'll do a little bit of, who was here to see the video? Okay, so about a third of you were here. So that's so unfair of me to show a video and then the rest of you can't see it today. But what I did, is I passed out this little sort of diagram because I kind of had a chance to think about how I was moving into this topic. And started thinking about it from the framework of, you know, how we define racism. And I put the definition of racism up on the board there. I could have moved y'all around, but they moved the mics around here. But that's, the board is going to be insignificant to our conversation. But put the definition of racism up that we use, race prejudice plus, and some people say race prejudice plus power is racism. And we have added to that race prejudice plus the misuse of systemic power of institutions and systems. And the reason why we did that is because we all have power, right? I mean, I have power. As a person of color, I have individual power. It's silly for me to walk around and assume I have no individual power, right? So we all have power. We all have the ability to act. And so we would constantly get you know, conversations from people about just kind of that use of the word power. I mean, that word is troubling to people, because most of us think we don't have any power. How many people here think they have power? How many people think they have lots of power? Some people think they have, okay, it was all the young people that raised their hand. We'll find out. No. Race prejudice, racism is the element of power. When I'm not talking about individual power, I'm talking about institutional power. And some people get really confused by the definition of racism, and we debate it a whole lot, because the whole notion of race is that all of us are race-based people, so all of us have the ability to be racist or act in racist ways. And so what we try to do in sort of defining this or coming clearer about this definition is to say we're not talking about individual prejudice. We're not talking about individual prejudice, because we all have the ability to be prejudiced, to be bigoted, to be as hurtful to each other, all of us, regardless of who we are in this world. We all carry those abilities. But people of color in this country historically do not have the power of institutions and systems. The institutions in this society were not created to serve people of color. Most institutions in this society were formed pre-1954. What happened in 1954?
School
desegregation. What happened in 1964? Civil rights. So if you think about all of our major institutions in society, all of them were formed pre-1964, pre-1954. And that's when we said segregation is no longer legal in the United States. But prior to that, segregation was the law of the land. So all institutions that were formed, and I mean major institutions, I'm not talking about the black church, I'm talking about major institutions that define life in the United States were formed pre-1954. And were not designed to serve people of color, because they had those little signs that said, color's not allowed. When I grew up in Battle Creek, Michigan, and I went to the train station as an adult, and I had moved away at that point, and I went to the train station as an adult, and it must have been like in the late 1960s, maybe early 1970s, and they still had a sign on the wall that listed all the churches in town, and in parentheses it had colored, white. It didn't have anything else, so I guess there weren't any other people there but colors and whites, but it sort of distinguished the two. And so, you know, up until late 60s, you know, and I would say that, you know, it's only been recently that most of our institutions have sort of taken the law seriously because of enforcement, but prior to that, our institutions did not serve people of color. And serve the interest of white society. And again, this is like an hour and 2.5 days, so if you want to debate about it, meet me outside. So that's kind of the definition. And then, so the operative word here, the operative words are race and power. And so we looked at race, and we looked at sort of the construction of race, and thinking about, you know, what is race, and, you know, I think most people are still real confused about what race is. That's a hard one. Because if your skin is brown, you're obviously different, right? Wrong. My little grandson is white. He's whiter than a lot of you guys in here. But he's a person of color. His ancestry is people of color, okay? So we know that race is a sociological construct that has very little biological basis to it, but we still use it as a way to divide people. We still use it as if it's something that's really real. And so we talked a little bit about that. So today what I wanted to talk about in looking at the video was to think about this concept of power and sort of how does power play out in this country in defining our relationships and defining this thing called racism. Well, the first day what we do in our model is we look at, Joe has this funny little thing that he does. Has anybody ever been in one of the Crossroads trainings? Okay, so you won't know this. He has this funny little thing that he talks about when he talks about power. He talks about power to the first, power to the second, and power to the third. Are there mathematicians in the room? I am not. So this notion of power to the first, power to the second, power to the third is like Greek to me. Well, maybe not Greek, because I'll be studying Greek sometime. But it's like French to me. And it's sort of the notion is that the component of power is what makes racism that thing that makes a difference in our society to sort of how we relate to each other and historically how those relationships have been defined. And so if you look at power one and compare it to power two, there's a big jump, right? are you the mathematician? There's a big jump in sort of the force and the power of that 1 to 2, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of like this exponential sort of equation stuff. I don't know nothing about that.
Mm-hmm.
So if we look at power one, what we see in our country is what racism has done to people of color, right? Historically, we know racism by what has happened to people of color. That's how we know something about racism. That racism has, you know, divided us from people of color. Racism has hurt people of color. Racism has oppressed people of color. I mean, we see the effects of that everywhere. In all of our institutions, we see what racism power has been over people of color. So we know that, right? Some of us are isolated from that. But if we don't know anything else about racism, that's what we know about racism, right? That it hurts people of color. It has hurt historically people of color from slavery up to the current time. So that's kind of the first level of racism's power, the power to hurt, the power to oppress people of color. Now, if that's all we know about racism, then what are our solutions to racism? If that's all we know about racism, then how do we deal with it? If it hurts people of color. Stop hurting people of color, okay? Or fix people of color, or do something to people of color. The object or whatever is those people of color. We've got to do something for them, to them. That's where our attention is for people of color, okay? So most of us know that. Most of us understand that. And many of us are confused by that. Because we see now race relations, and there isn't slavery, and there isn't legal segregation, but there's a lot of other stuff. And it's that other stuff that's really confusing about who's hurting who, and how racism operates, how racism functions. And we'll talk more about internalization in a minute, but it's sort of, we look at that and we say, it's them people hurting each other. That the racism is black on black crime. It's those black people and those Korean people who can't get along with each other. I mean, that's what we see and that's what we understand, because it's really confusing. Now, we may say people who are maybe more involved or enlightened may understand, well, maybe it's a little bit more than just that. But that's what the general population sees, and that's what they understand about racism. And what they want to do is, they want to end racism because they see it coming closer and closer to them. So if there's crime on the streets, then the next thing is, I'm going to be the victim of that crime. And so I want to end racism so that I won't be the victim. That's what the average person on the street feels about racism, that it's coming closer to me. It's no longer a problem that's hurting people of color. It's a problem that people of color have been hurt, and somehow they're acting out that hurt. And my God, we ended slavery. There's no more segregation. So why are these people so angry? Why do they keep acting like that? So that's sort of, you know, we kind of get really caught up in that. Then power two gives us a different glimpse of racism. Power two says, okay, there's a reason for this. There's a reason for why people of color are hurt. Wonder what that reason is. And most people don't go very far in really trying to understand what that reason is, because it gets real close to home. And if we start thinking about the function of race, what was the purpose of race in the first place in this society? The purpose of race was to define who had rights and who didn't have rights. Then we start thinking, well, if the function of race, the function of creating these categories that divided people, was to define who had land, who could have land. In the early 1600s, the first laws on the books in the English colonies was about who could have land and who couldn't have land. And that's where you first see a designation around race in any sort of official documents in the United States. defining who had the right to own land and who didn't have the right. And then you start to see laws that talk about relationships between slaves and free people. Those relationships being, you know, whoever helps in the freedom of a slave, and you start seeing laws that divide relationships, who could marry who. And so we start to see the function of these, the function of the of race as a concept being really sort of built into sort of the fabric of our society. And what are they defining? They're defining who has and who doesn't have. Who has rights and who doesn't have rights and all of those. So we start saying, okay, well, if the function of racism, what is the function of racism? Well, some people say it's God's law. We'll talk about that later. We know that's not true, right? Some people say, well, you know, we define race, these people are less than. And so therefore, racism is just, you know, people living out who they are and us reacting to that. And then we start thinking, wait a minute, who has in this country and who doesn't have in this country? And why and how has that happened? And then we start looking at the function, the reason for racism is to maintain white privilege, to maintain privilege for a certain group of people that in the 1600s were written into the laws as a way of keeping, holding those privileges for that group of people. So then we start looking at the power of racism is really not about hurting people of color. They just happen to be the byproducts of it. The purpose of racism is to maintain power and privilege for white society. White society. And how whites get in, how whites buy into that is living up to the myth that we're raised to think about what it means to be, what it means to be not that, as opposed to what it means to be this. Because very few white people grew up thinking about being white, right? We talked about this the other day. How many of you grew up thinking about being white? And still don't. I mean, it's not something that, you know, you carry around. And, you know, I was reading, years ago, I was working with a women's group, and we were doing some role plays. And I used to work in sexual assault work. And there's a whole lot of stuff around race and sexual assault work, because there's a lot of history around crime and sexual assault in this country that's very race-based. And so I designed this role play, and I described the woman in the role play as a white woman. The white woman, blah, blah, and this friend of mine read it, and she said, oh. And I said, what? And she said, oh, I'm reading this, and it says, and the white woman, because you're not used to those words being jumped out on her like that. It's like, you know, the woman. But, and you hear, you know, whenever you sort of hear news reports, I'm always stunned when they say he was a white man. I'm happy when there was a crime committed by a white man. You know, I'm waiting to hear it. I'm waiting to hear it. And when they don't say who it is, and I'm wondering, why are they not saying it? Is it because they're trying to protect him? Is it trying to protect us? But anyway, we sort of don't use white. We don't understand the function of whiteness in the society because it's been defined as the norm. Mm-hmm. And so racism's power to the second power is about how do you preserve power and privilege? How do you understand what it means to be white in society and to kind of get close to that? So power two is really kind of defining that and understanding that. There's a very good video that probably all of you've seen, because just the whole world has probably seen it by now. It's called True Colors. And it's a primetime special. It was done about 7 or 8 years ago, where there's two testers, a black tester and a white tester, that's in St. Louis, and they go around and they test for discrimination. And there have been some primetime specials in the last couple of years that have sort of done sort of the same kind of experiment. And they show these two guys, and what they're really trying to do is to test for situations of discrimination. Well, we turn the video around and we say, We don't want you to look at when Glenn was being discriminated against. We want you to look at when Glenn, when John was getting privileges. What were the privileges that John had? So these two young men go into a store, and who do you think gets followed? It's not the white guy. Who do you think gets instant service? It's the white guy. So we're looking at those times in which privileges, what does it mean to live your life? Well, you don't have to worry about these things. Well, these are not things that are part of your everyday life. And then to worry about, I have a son who's 26 years old. He's gorgeous. I think he is. He's got, you know, really nice long dreadlocks, and he's just the most handsome man on the face of the earth. Except your husband. I know you think he's the most handsome man on the face of the earth. But he is really a handsome young man. He has been stopped every year since he was 16 years old. He has been stopped every year since he's been 16 years old because he's a black man in America. And you know what my friends tell me? Well, why don't you go to the police department and protest? Not in Chicago. He's not going to survive. So that, you know, he carries that around. And I would probably venture to say that most of the men in this room don't even think about getting stopped unless you're driving around with a expired driver's license or something, and you're feeling guilty anyway.
Some of the best testers in that regard are international students of color who come to Cal Lutheran, and they have no idea what they're up against. Mm-hmm. And they drive or walk around Thousand Oaks, and they're shocked for the first time in their life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They're absolutely shocked.
They're shocked.
And then the African Americans of the United who've grown up in the United States have to explain to them what's going on.
My son lost a job in New York because he went to get an apartment, and he went to look at the apartment. He was in New York for a week. He'd never been to New York. I didn't want him to go to New York, but he had to go. And he went looking for an apartment on his rollerblades. Now, can you imagine a drug deal on rollerblades? He wasn't doing a drug deal. He was on rollerblades. And he went to look at this apartment, and the police had staked out the building that he was in. They arrested him, took him to jail, kept him in jail 24 hours. He lost the job that he was supposed to be at the next day. He called them and told them, "This is what happened to me." And they said, "Sorry, we don't want you." I said, "Get your butt back to Chicago." It's a little safer there, not much, but a little safer there. You know, how many people would that happen to? I mean, it's just, you know. So anyway, there's lots and lots of examples. So power two is about white power and privilege, and just thinking about what does it mean to be white in America? What does it mean? And it doesn't mean giving those power, this doesn't mean giving those privileges up. It just means that, understand that there are some people who don't get them because of the color of their skin. So then the third power, which is exponentially much more powerful than power two, is the power of racism, the power that racism has to make racists and victims out of all of us. Now, this system couldn't function if we didn't all buy into it, right? I mean, we wouldn't have... If we have to somehow buy into this myth about people of color and what that means for us in order for it to continue for 400 years. For somehow we have to be socialized into this paradigm about race. And so power three is really about what racism's destructive power is over all of us. Now, white people don't think much about the destruction of racism in their life. Because, you know, if you live a pretty normal life, you know, then you may think about how it hurts other people. But, maybe it's not impacting you. This is a hard one for people of color, too. Because for most people of color, they think, I don't care what happens to white people. This is about my survival. But the reality is that none of us are surviving, really. And, you know, and I think about a place like Holden Village. I mean, this is a place where people come for spiritual renewal, for a way to sort of look at the problems of the world. And so I would assume that most people come here realize that there's something about their own brokenness that has to do with their relationship to people of color in this world, is why people that like you come to Holden Village. I mean, there's a whole lot of people that don't come to Holden Village because they could care less. They're broken too. They just don't know it yet. They're living in major denial. So we talk about the prism of racism for white people. And I think it's important to think about what is that prism? What does that prism feel like? What does that prism do? How do you think about in your life what that prism means? And so we stopped the other day, and I think the first day we kind of looked at racism through the lenses of sort of power one, its impact on people of color. Day two, we kind of looked at white privilege and what does it mean to be white and how do you understand that? And then day three, we talked about the socializing impact, and the video showed the socializing impact of racism. So for those of you that are here, I understand that there's some questions or conversation that people had about that video. So I'm just offering an opportunity to have some conversation at this point. Because what I want to talk about now is how racism socializes us. And what we saw is we saw seven groups of women talking about the impact of racism on their lives and what it does to destroy not only the day-to-day living, but their very being and their very humanity. And we saw a group of white women, which is kind of unusual, you know, in this world. It happens. It happens in more places than it used to. But sort of this whole notion of how does racism destroy white people? So I'm opening it up for somebody. Say something.
Well, I came away from it. Well, I ask you, what can I do? What can I do?
What did you see happening? For those of you who saw it, what happened? What do you remember about what happened in that video? And this is
awful
kind
lot
of
hurt.
A lot of hurt.
An
okay.
awful lot of hurt.
Okay.
And that bothered. It's not the first time I've seen this kind of hurt, because I worked with a lot of blacks. I've worked at a university that had a lot of people of color.
Mm-hmm.
And that hurt worries me. That's pain, and pain is a symptom, and I want to do something about it.
Mm-hmm. Who else had an impression of the video?
I thought there was, a lot of hurt, which in turn created a lot of anger, you know, towards, you know, that the racism caused in their life. But what impacted me was the the people that were mixed race, and not only did they have to face that racism, that they just seemed so incredibly confused about who they were and who to identify with. Like, which side of the family do I identify with, my white mother or my black father or my Asian mother? And they were just incredibly confused.
Mm-hmm. What else? Other people? What is internalized racist oppression? What does that mean, that concept? Anybody want to jump at it?
Does it mean like internalized racial oppression?
Mm-hmm.
Does it mean like not outwardly expressing your racist feelings or thoughts, but like poisoning yourself from the inside, so you get the thought process and it goes more subtle than it is to actually go, you know, shave your head and join the Nazis or something.
Mm-hmm. Okay, you're hitting on. We have a 16-year-old start us off here.
I understand it as hearing in your own mind reflections of the racist world on the outside. So instead of racism being something from the outside coming in. Instead, it's something that we or people of color especially can hear the same sort of stuff kind of coming out.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's my understanding.
Okay. What else? So we got to the internal stuff.
It's kind of like so deeply ingrained. Like we live on a street that's multicultural. Our neighborhood is, thank God. But when I walk down, I notice people's color. And I wish I didn't. I wish I did. And I thought, oh, there's Mary. But I noticed right away, oh.
There's Black Mary.
There's Black Mary. I know, and I just wish I didn't. But, you know, it's so.
I'm happy they used to do that.
Oh, but it's so. But you know, the truth is, I did notice that you were black when I first met you, but I haven't thought of it again. But I don't know my neighbors. Do you know? I don't know them. I don't know their names. And I wish I wouldn't think that. I wish it would be like I would just look at someone and not even. Because it's not about the culture.
Mm-hmm.
It's just so deeply ingrained.
Mm-hmm. So it's something that's deeply ingrained, you know, sort of our society. So there's two pieces of this. Because remember, we're talking about two sides of the puzzle. We're not just talking about people of color. We're talking about what happens to white people as well. Okay, racism can't happen if somebody isn't doing it. And you know, again, we could debate whether or not it's just something that happens within those communities, but I would be here for a couple of years debating with you because I would win that debate. But we're talking about it, two sides of the puzzle here. One is about and they're both about internalization. One is about internalization of racist oppression. Who's being oppressed? People of color, right? So when we're talking about internalization of racist oppression, we're talking about people of color. And if I would say what is internalization of racist superiority, who would I be talking about? White folks, okay? So we're talking about two types of internalization, the socialization process happening for both folks. Now, what are people of color internalizing? What were they talking about in the video? What were they internalizing?
Well, I didn't see the video,
okay.
So I can't speak for that.
I forgot.
I worry a lot that little black children are internalizing the fact that they're not as good as their little friends, that all these things are happening and that they are going to buy into it. And
Okay. That's
a real word.
Okay. So in this video, we saw women talking about standards of beauty. Who's beautiful in this country and who's not beautiful? And what does that look like? You know, what does that standard look like? So that's one message. And, you know, I mean, it's amazing to me. It's all around us. And it's amazing to me that it's all around us more now than it was 10 years ago. You know, they talk about these movie stars who are size zero.
Yes.
You know, so that means they don't exist as far as I'm concerned. But they're, you know, I mean, it's all around us. You know, Barbie is strong. You know, Barbie is probably the strongest female role model we have in this country. So it's not a subtle message. It's a real strong message. And so, you know, we all try to live up to that image, you know. Some of us do. Some of us have lost hope. But, you know, standards of beauty. Did you?
I want not to pull out the window, but I've taught literature for a long time, and I've really tried to emphasize themes that will cut across the races, and one of those is that most women do not like their image, their bodies, you know, and I think that it's in most of the literature, it's proven that it is a degree worse for women of color, but they don't necessarily have the corner on the market. White women are doing this to themselves too.
Exactly.
So I think that self-hate business, that's what I would point at. How do children in this country, let's just talk about this country, grow up hating themselves, suffering from inferiority or really very low self-esteem? I understand that is behind a lot of crime, low self-esteem.
Mm-hmm.
And what can we do to build up the esteem of children? I know a lot of people are working on this. How do you come to respect yourself?
Have any of you seen the video, the brown-eyed, blue-eyes experiment?
Oh, yes.
We did the brown-eyed, blue-eyes.
That's right. I mean, that's exactly what we're talking about. We're talking about how does, and the teacher was a socializing element in that video. She said kids who have brown eyes are not as smart as, not as good as, not as, you know, all these things, and the kids bought it just like that. And do we think that we have, you know, escaped the socialization that's happened in this country? No, we haven't. And even as adults, you know, we do this exercise where we say, what do people think about poor people? What do people say about poor people? And people start out by saying, oh, why are people poor? Oh, people are poor because society structures it like that. Oh, blah, 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 blah. And then I say, okay, you're standing in a grocery line and somebody's standing behind you talking. Why are they saying people are poor? Well, because they're lazy, they don't want to get a job, they want to stay on welfare. So, I mean, we're bombarded, whether we like it or not, we're bombarded with things that people continue to internalize about who they are. And it is about self-hate.
I remember it now. It has to do with perceptions. I think very early experiences can form your perceptions, the way you see yourself and the world for the rest of your life.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have a harsh, discriminating experience, well, it could even be a mild one, not a harsh one, when you're still growing up, it can stay with you your whole life. That is, you build on it. You tend to build on it in your head. You know, so the next time somebody pushes you, whether it's a racial push or not, you know, the reason is racial or not, you could interpret that just as I, growing up a white girl, often felt almost embarrassed or ashamed about how lily white I was. I didn't feel, when I get together with my black friends, a really rich, funky experience in life. Mm-hmm. Do you see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
When you start to perceive the world that way, I think that's the insidious part about it. You know, how do we eradicate, how do we get rid of those kinds of perceptions that we tend to build on? Just the way we see the world.
Okay, the way she's talking about how earlier experience came up for me, the fact, I wonder how early does the experience have to be, because I remember in my elementary school, I can remember in all 5 years, 6 years of my elementary school, I remember seeing two black people. And I remember first grade, I was 6 years old, that was one of those black people, and I remember he sat in the back, and we all watched him like a hawk to see, make him make a mistake. So we could point him out to the teacher, and the teacher could punish him. Actually, our teacher was black too. But he'd be folding a piece of paper, we'd call on an airplane to see if he could get in trouble. I was never raised to think like that. I don't know how it happened.
Well, you know, we live in a world that is just not our parents. You know, I mean, we live in a world that, and they say that kids who are, by the time kids are 3 years old, they've already sort of have, they already have a racial paradigm.
Mm-hmm.
In their being, and they can begin to put experiences in those racial paradigms. I mean, those little kids in that video, they were like third graders, and those little kids were very articulate in the very beginning when they asked them, who do we discriminate against in this country? And they said, the black people. And this was in 1967, and these were third graders. So, I mean, you know, we don't have to be in anybody, we don't ever have to interact with a person of color in this country to not know about what happens, what the racial divide is, because unless you don't watch TV, and there are a lot of people who don't watch TV, but it exists. So internalization of racist oppression, let me just read what the women in the group said, because this is what they said about the experience that they had. If I can find it here. They talked about the themes that we heard was about the destruction of their history, that they didn't know what their history was. And I remember the black woman talking about, when she thought about slavery, she always thought about it in a real negative way because that's what she was raised to think about who she was. So, and the Native American women, the woman who talked about her grandmother who didn't teach her the ways
of Indian life because she held that from her head. She didn't even know that her grandmother was an Indian. The destruction of culture. I mean, it's only been in the last 20 years that people of color, black people, even realize that they have culture. Because the message was, you don't have a culture. And to have a culture, you have to want European music and art, and that's culture. But what you do is not culture. So the destruction, identity shaping. I think the mixed race group had much more to say about the confusion around identity. But everybody talked about identity. White women talked about being confused about identity. Who are they in this world? Their humanity being defined. The African American woman talked about the Jezebel image. And the image, what does that mean and say about who I am as a person? Standards of beauty, language being denied, rape, abuse, and violence. And isn't it funny how we wonder why these little kids are picking up guns, not just in the inner city, but all over the country, and shooting people? We wonder. Now, I'm not going to sit here and say it's because of racism, but I certainly think that what produces racism also produces somebody who can pick up a gun and go to school and shoot a bunch of kids. There's a whole, and a lot of those stories, though, are about kids. A lot of those themes revolve around sexism and racism. And so kids being angry and confused and not understanding, mistrust of each other, land, not having land, stealing. So these were a lot of the themes that came up in the video. Now, quickly, I want to go and say, what is then, if that's internalization of racist oppression, then what is internalization of superiority, and how does that happen?
Well, that's just your, like, not your conscious knowledge of being better than someone, but simply, like, it's just so, like, just so ingrained in you that you can't think anything else. Mm-hmm. You can't possibly think, well, maybe that person might be better. It's just, no, it's just there.
Just is.
You can't even just deny saying, I don't have a nose. You can't deny that.
Mm-hmm. I have to consciously counteract racist thoughts. And I had to tell my parents, you use the N-word, you don't see your grandchildren. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's, and they stopped. I thought, yes, you don't even know that. Because they stopped or they weren't going to see you. The thing is, I thought you wouldn't have it. You know, I thought that, I knew I was going to struggle. It was too early, but I'm sad.
Well, this
our
is...
Our schools are better.
Okay.
We have better jobs.
Okay.
I don't get hassled at a place like you said. I don't get treated awful.
And all those experiences shape an identity that says, it's because I am trustworthy, I am good, I am faithful, I am smart, I am all of these things, and I am this, and they are not. Because I am these things and they are not. So it's kind of the socialization that says, if you want to get the goods in this society, you better believe these myths. Because if you don't believe them, you're not going to get the goods. You align yourselves with these other folks, you are labeled what? This is a religious setting, so we don't like to use these words. But if you find yourself aligning yourself with people of color, there used to be a time when you're called a nigger lover. And you became isolated from the race. You were kicked out of the club. You weren't allowed to be a part of the club if you didn't believe those things. And how painful is it to get kicked out of your family, your neighborhood? Well, my mother was kicked out of her family when she decided to marry my father. And I'll tell you what the pain of racism did to my aunt, who was as racist as they came. She was a manic depressive for 35 years. For 10 years of that time, she never left her house. She never walked out her door. She lived with one of the most racist men, and he was wonderful to her. But he was extremely racist, and he said, you will have nothing to do with your sister. She won't come here. She won't bring her little black kids here. For 35 years, my aunt was a manic depressive. The last 10 years, she was depressed. Her husband died. The very first thing she did when her husband died was picked up the phone and called my mother. If that isn't a story of brokenness and separation and pain, I don't know what is. She was broken and separated from her family. And that is what has happened to lots of people unconsciously. So this is how it happens. I'm going to just talk about four ways that it happens. Isolation, segregation, separation, white flight, separate lives, everything that we do, we're isolated from each other. You know, we have public spaces, but how many of us have private spaces that are integrated? Mm-hmm. Probably not a whole lot. Mm-hmm. You know, we may work with people of color, you know, we may see them, but we don't have private lives that have people of color in them very much. Anesthesia, that for whites, you forgot how to feel. And being privileged in America says you buy into it. You buy into it or you get none of the goods of this society. So if everybody's moving to the suburbs, you better hightail it to the suburbs because you're going to be left in the neighborhood with all those folks and you're going to be labeled as all these things. And it, you know, it happens. We don't want it to happen. It happens. We're part, and I think one of the things what racism does is we're part of a, white people are part of a collective. So I don't look at you and say, you know, you're a doggone so-and-so-and-so. I see you as part of a collective. And so what has happened to white people is they have collectively been socialized into thinking and experiencing their lives this way. So numb to the feelings, numb to, you know, the realities that happen in this world that hurt people of color. We're really getting very numb to those realities. And feeling that brokenness. In the video, the white women in that group were broken. Did you see that? Do you remember seeing what the brokenness felt like? The one woman who was talking about, you know, she just couldn't reconcile being there and not being there at the same time, and she lived a very privileged life, but it was obviously extremely painful for her that she was separated, and somehow she couldn't break out of that. That was a prison that she could not break out of, but it was her, it was killing her. And the notion of privilege, and Joe talks about the deepest fear in white people, again, that we're socialized, is the fear that the end of racism will be our loss and the continuation of racism is our gain. So now if we have to start sharing everything with those people of color, then what's going to happen?
Well, yeah.
So we have to believe that there's something different about us.
Like a lot of it hinges on economics. I think a lot of people may not feel like they're racist, but if you think about people of color starting to move into a neighborhood, then the flight begins, not because they have anything against people, but because the property values go down.
Right. And the property values are going to go down because somebody said these people don't live quite as better, as good as we do. They don't take care of their property, they don't take care of their kids, you know, so, and you know what? All that is happening outside of us. But that's the message, that's the deep message that we get. And that's, and we buy it. Because that's what socialization is all about. And then the, and then finally the programming and conditioning that happens and the, in our institutions to make us believe that there is such thing as people of color who aren't smart enough. I mean, it was just a few years ago that the bell curve came out and talked about the, you know, IQs and the inability of people of color to be able to learn. I mean, this stuff just keeps being surfaced over and over and over again. And, you know, if you are broken people, and we're all broken, I guess the point I'm trying to make is that there's something about our humanity that is very broken. And if our struggle is for wholeness, sometimes we're looking in the wrong direction. We're looking for here, and America is about consumption, it's about all these things that make us whole. How much of that really makes us whole? I mean, you know, we were talking about cars today, and you know how unfaithful cars are to us. But we need a car, and we need a good car, you know. And so, and the ads tell us, you better get this one, because if you don't get this one, then you're not somehow, you know, quite as good as the next guy, or gonna go fast as the next guy, or whatever. But we're all sort of socialized into sort of this, with the same programming, the same message over and over again. And if we think we're beyond that, we're fooling ourselves. It wasn't just the third graders in Riceville, Iowa that were able she actually did this experiment with adults, and they were worse than the kids. So anyway, the whole idea that the power of racism is about hurting people of color for the purpose of white power and privilege, and that the only way that it happens is that somehow we buy into these identities. We buy into this notion of who they are and who we are, and we internalize and we live out those messages. And that's the more powerful, that is the worst power of racism than what people of color will say, no, we're not getting to, I don't want to hear about how white people are hurt. I want them to hear about how I'm hurt. But I think until white people understand their own brokenness in this scheme, I have no hope ever that they'll ever come to my side of the table. What's in it for them? If the notion is...
It's like an abusive marriage, really, when you think of it that way. Mm-hmm. The abuser needs to see that this is his brokenness, his or her brokenness, and is damaging to his soul, and just as it is for the person who's being abused, isn't it, right? Mm-hmm. And it's hard for that person who's in that one-up position to see that. Mm-hmm. Even though it's not free, and there's nothing free about it, is there? Mm-hmm. It is imprisonment, as you're saying, really, for everybody.
So, just a few minutes, maybe not, but I always get to this point. We have to get to the next day, but comments?
Well, as I think about this, it's still interesting that affirmative action doesn't exist in something more. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about reverse racism, not reverse prejudice, because white people have to stand in line a little bit too. So they just changed the law again. They put it back away. Well, it didn't quite be like it was before, but they changed it. It's not there anymore. Mm-hmm. Schools, colleges, at least state institutions, no more affirmative action stuff. Well, what does that do? You look at the least numbers I saw in that magazine the other day. The number of black people in universities is lower again. Guess what a surprise. Mm-hmm. It's real intentional. Mm-hmm. It's real intentional.
You've been very helpful to me in talking about the numbing of feelings. Some of us here are from South Carolina. Mm-hmm. And as you know, tomorrow, the Confederate flag will come down off of our Capitol, mm-hmm. thanks to the work of a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And the process that state has gone through to get to that point has been so intense and so emotional. And at times, as horrible as it's been for us, we've just wanted to yank that thing down anytime. There's been something, because I think you hit it on the head when you said the numbing of feelings. Because what I think happened is people began to realize that they had numbed feelings and began to be free about expressing whichever side they were on. Mm-hmm. And so we hope that some healing will come out of that. But mm-hmm. tomorrow is the day. Mm-hmm.
And tomorrow we're going to be talking about reparations. So that'll be good. and we'll sort of... put a little bit of the church piece on this, but tomorrow we're going to be talking about the book, The Debt. I didn't bring it today, but there's some in there. And there's been this is a current issue around, okay, what do we want to be restored? And what does that mean? And where is that debate going to go? So,
what time is your class tomorrow morning?
Same time, 6:20.